I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. I'm here today with Alyssa Valentina Knight, a renowned cybersecurity influencer, content creator, entrepreneur, published author, and a recovering hacker of 20 years. Alyssa began hacking when she was 13, was arrested at 17 for hacking into a government network, and has since reformed, working with the U.S. government intelligence agencies and greater cyber community. She has been featured on Wired, Fox, and Dark Reading, among many others, and is also a prolific speaker at industry events and conferences. You can visit her website at alyssanight.com. Alyssa, welcome to Cybercrime Radio. I'm so excited to have you on the show.
Thank you, Hillary. I need to transpose that into my new LinkedIn profile. That was the best introduction for me I've ever heard.
Well, I will give it to you. You can have it. You can take credit for it.
Yay!
Yeah. My gift to you.
Oh, thank you.
Of course. And before we begin, I know the last time you and I spoke, you were in the process of moving. So how are your new digs?
Oh, I love it. Just a short background on me. I actually met my wife at Black Hat Briefings.
Oh, cool.
And we met in August of 2018. And then I was living in Seattle at the time. And then I relocated to Las Vegas and moved in with her just a few months later. And then we got married a year later. And so I've relocated to Las Vegas, and we just recently, as you mentioned, finished building our own house. And so we just moved in on Friday. So things are good. We're still living in out of boxes.
Yeah.
But you know, we went through, it was a pretty hellacious process. We actually were living in a hotel since October.
Oh, so, wow. Yeah. Well, it takes a while to build a house.
Yeah. But I mean, like, we were supposed to close in December, and they're just problem after problem. Mm-hmm. And long story short, we finally made it in, and so I don't have, so apparently there's this global foam shortage. I don't know if the audience knows about it.
No. Yeah,
because of COVID, like, furniture, there's a 3 to 6 month lead time for furniture.
Wow.
And so this is the absolute worst possible time to furnish a house.
Oh no.
So we have no furniture. We're sleeping on a blow up mattress, and we have computer desks. That's it.
Well,
that's the most important thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, my husband and I renovated our house, and so we had everything gutted for a while. And I used to walk my friends and family through, and I was like, and this is my dancing room, and this is my dancing room, because everything was just bare. So you have lots of dancing rooms.
Exactly. Lots of ballet and dancing rooms.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh, well, you kind of alluded to this, but to start off, your introduction packs a serious punch, but I suspect that although I did the best job I could, I've left more to be desired with our audience. So could you share a high level bio with us? And I can already tell that you're a great storyteller, so I'd really love you to kind of set the scene for us.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I've always lived my life by the mantra that I have the same amount of time in a 24-hour day than the homeless person on the street, or than Tim Cook. I have the same amount of time in a day that Bill Gates has, or, you know, Jeff Bezos. So what am I going to do with my time? And so I may have been taking that to a very radical level, but I've taken on a lot. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've started and sold multiple companies. I sold my first company when I was 20. Sold my second successful startup when I was 27. I've started a venture capital funds. I'm a day trader. Mm-hmm. I'm a published author. I'm writing a new book. I was approached by producers. They wanted to produce a new TV series based on my life. So I'm writing a screenplay. I'm in the process of writing the pilot episode right now for a new, it's going to be Netflix or Amazon Prime new TV series on me. So yeah, it's life is good. I'm having a good time. I'm learning new things. I'm sort of all over the place. I'm the ADD poster child, but it's worked out well, because I'm, you know, it's like that quote, we're all very busy, but not productive. I aim to be productive.
Yeah. I love that. And that's really cool about the series. I'm excited. Congratulations on that. That's huge.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to write a TV series and it's going to be really easy. I'll go download Scrivener and I'll figure out how to write a screenplay. And it's going to be really easy because they're going to be TV shows. It's not going to be as hard as writing a movie screenplay. And then I found out the hard way that an entire first season of a TV series is equivalent to writing a screenplay for five movies.
Oh.
So it's a lot of work. I definitely may have taken on more than I can chew, but I'm learning a lot and I'm having a good time doing it.
That's good. And I mean, that does sound like more work, but at the same time, I think it'll, you know, maybe in a optimistic world, you know, give you more space to tell your story, which is very cool than a movie would.
Yeah. It's, you know, I mean, so not only am I a woman in a very male dominated industry, but I'm also a lesbian. I'm also transgendered. So I've, you know, all of these unconscious biases against me.
Yeah.
So I think it's just been this push to really overachieve, right? Because,
right.
You know, I was joking with someone the other day about that, actually with Chloe and on their podcast over at ITSB Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
I was saying it in jest, but there was some seriousness to it. It's like, you know, you hear that whole, well, you know, I report to a woman, but she's so mean because it's like, she's trying to overcompensate, but it's true though. You're right. Like, we do have to really overcompensate. It's, you know, we have to really bring it in our jobs. We have to really bring it because we, you know, there's this certain unconscious bias and expectation of, you know, being a woman in cybersecurity. I mean, I've fought it, you know, a very viral thread on Twitter went crazy that added like 3,000 new subscribers to my Twitter feed. That just for me chiming in where a guy said, you know, cybersecurity was too fast paced for women. Ugh, you know, this is real stuff. This isn't stuff we just kind of are making up that guys say, but there's a widespread belief out there that we need to combat as women. That, you know, cybersecurity isn't for us.
Right.
And so I'm always trying to, I think that's the ghost I'm out there fighting every day. Right.
That sounds very motivating for you.
Yeah.
And so I guess this is a good place to start off too, is what got you interested in hacking at a young age? Like, when/how did you first become exposed to technology?
So I started working when I was 12, and this is actually fresh content. I've never talked about this on any other show. Yeah.
Exclusive.
You heard it here first. Cybercrime Magazine. So I got my first job when I was 12. It was at a Japanese restaurant, and I would go there and work after school, and my boss would work very closely with my mom and making sure I was getting my homework done. And then I got another job at a Greek restaurant, and those two managers worked together to make sure my schedule, they coordinated on my schedule. And I saved up and bought my first computer. It was a 486 SX25. And I just knew that I wanted to learn how to build computers and learn all about them. And from a very young age, used to like to take things apart because I felt that was the best way that I could learn. And if you think about it, hacking is really nothing more than taking apart something. It's learning how the developers made it, how it works, and then figuring out the stimulus that the developer didn't expect to receive. So that's really how I started out. I started out building a computer, then, you know, got involved in IRC, which was Internet Relay Chat, started meeting hackers on IRC and learning from them. And then I got into the BBS scene, and I got involved in the underground art scene at the time, anti-ASCII art stuff. And
cool.
And then that's how I kind of got into hacking. Was I just, at the time, there really wasn't, you know, there wasn't Sands Institute. There wasn't all these places you could go to get, a cybersecurity degree. It was never heard of back then. It just, you know, it just wasn't a thing. So you really had to learn on your own. You really couldn't rely on anybody because there were very few people who really understood it and you know, actually gave you the time of day. So I sort of taught myself. And in a time when there really wasn't, you know, there was no YouTube,
Right.
There was no YouTube in 1992 and 93 years. So
I love that story.
Oh, sorry.
No.
So I'll carry that further.
Yeah, yeah.
So the first network I hacked into was a fast food chain, believe it or not.
Okay.
Yeah. Didn't get caught for that one. Didn't get arrested for that one. But the one I got arrested for was a government network, and they were waiting for me at school. I was in high school. And I was so close to graduating. My parents were like, oh, she was so close. And I think it was like a few months before I was supposed to graduate.
Okay.
So I went from the biggest nerd in school that got picked on to the coolest kid in school, because they were, the agent stormed on me when I got out of my car and was walking to the quad, and it just felt different. And all of a sudden they came out and nabbed me. And so, my dad was actually quite comedic about the whole situation. He's like, most parents have to pick up their kids from jail for, drugs or stealing or, God forbid, murder or something, or whatever, some sort of, felony. I picked mine up because she hacked into a government network.
Well, that's
bragging rights.
But you weren't arrested, or like you got off on a technicality, right?
Yeah. So I don't know what was going on with the arresting agent, but didn't really know what he was doing.
Okay.
And the wrote it up under industrial espionage. I mean, this was a very different time, right? Like
sure.
Today, arresting officers, agents, they know what charges, they know, and there's just a lot more case law around it. It was a very nascent time and Computer Fraud and Abuse Act kind of stuff. And I was questioned. I was interrogated without my parents there. And so the district attorney did not want to touch the case because I was interrogated without a lawyer, without a, I don't even think I had my Miranda rights read to me. It was really strange. It was a very strange arrest. I don't know, looking back, maybe this was even intentional. Maybe the agent just wanted, didn't want me to get in trouble for it because it was so cool. But I don't know. I thought it was cool, but that's my perspective. But, so basically the DA didn't want to touch it. And so I got let off, and my career in cybersecurity began. I knew that wasn't the direction I wanted my life to go. And so I started my first company and sold it to a public company in British Columbia. And I started that when I was 17 and sold it when I was 20. Then started my second successful startup when I was 24, and then sold it when I was 27. And then I was asked to speak on the Al-Qaeda cyber attack threats on Fox News Live. And as soon as the episode was over, I got contacted by the FBI. And went to go work for the U.S. intelligence community in cyber warfare.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. And yeah, that's a good point. I didn't even think of Al-Qaeda and that timing of all of that happening.
Yeah, this was like, post 9/11, and Al-Qaeda was a thing versus, ISIS today. They were threatening to attack our critical infrastructure. A lot of people think that terrorists are just, don't know what they're doing. They're sitting in caves and, but they're very sophisticated. I mean, they were using steganography and child porn to communicate. Just really advanced stuff, writing their own software. They're not cave dwellers. They're very versed in technology. So there was a lot of input that I had in that area. And that began my career in working for the U.S. intelligence community, and started my new company, Briar and Thorn, which began providing counterinsurgency support in Afghanistan and Iraq, and working with the IC. After a while, began working in critical infrastructure support.
Okay, cool. So that became a really dominant area of intelligence for you, and cybersecurity is protecting us and our infrastructures from terrorists.
Yeah. Cybersecurity is a very more elite than thou kind of industry, right? It's very easy to become very cynical. there's a lot of arrogance in the industry. There's a lot of things that women, especially those in the LGBT community, are up against. And, you know, it's a daily thing. And I think I just got tired of it. And I after I sold my last company, Applied Watch, I just needed a break from it. And that's when, you know, I ran into the FBI and the intelligence community and just wanted to do something different. So I went to close quarter combat training. I was the first woman to go through private SEER. So I went through SEER training and, you know, traded my keyboard in for an M4 and AR-15, took sniper courses. Yeah. And actually traded in for real bullets. And, you know, this was around the time of Blackwater, if you remember them, and high risk zone close protection with private military companies and private military contracts. So Brian Thorne actually, it's an MSSP today, but it started out as a defense contracting company providing COIN support. And we actually won two contracts, a counter IED contract in Iraq and a counter insurgency advisory and assistance team contract in Afghanistan. And, you know, really just wanted to get away from cyber for a while and then got tired of being shot at in all of that mess and decided to go back to hacking. And, you know, it's I feel like cybersecurity today is way different than it was 20 years ago. If you recall, Hillary, it was about defacing websites, right? It was defacing IIS web servers. Rafa was here, World of Hell, mass defacements. Today, it's about data theft. It's about monetization. It's state and non-state sponsored actors. And, you know, a lot of it, especially with IoT and, you know, any car made after 2001 being connected, you have the ability to actually impact human life, right? So I don't know if you remember, maybe like a month ago, there was that, it was the first published news story on someone dying as a direct reflection, as a direct result of a cybersecurity incident.
Right.
There was a hospital in Germany that was infected by ransomware and they had to move a patient in critical condition to a new hospital and she died in transit. So, you know, I mean, I think things have just gotten very interesting and I feel like I'm at a point in my career now where I kind of stay out of that drama within cybersecurity. I try and stay out of it as much as I can. And then if you notice my social media influence and, you know, they're on Twitter or LinkedIn or YouTube, you'll notice that there was this sort of fundamental shift that happened with my content where it went from, you know, really not just wanting to address the fact that I was trans or, you know, part of the LGBT community, where I began talking about it more because I really didn't want me being trans to be the issue. But I realized I was tired of seeing too many transgendered children committing suicide.
Yeah.
I think what did it for me was the trans girl who threw herself into oncoming traffic because her parents didn't accept the fact that she was trans. And talking to so many trans children, youth who didn't think that they had a potential career ahead of them because they were trans, because they felt the world was against them. And I felt it was my responsibility to change my narrative and start talking more about the fact that I was trans because, hey, look, you know, you trans youth, you know, Jane, Jim, here I am, I'm trans and look at all of these accomplishments. Look at what I've done despite the fact that I'm trans.
Right.
You know, I've started and sold companies. I've started a venture capital fund. You can work in white collar work. You don't have to go into the adult entertainment industry just because you're trans. You don't have to, you know, sell your body on the side of the street to pay for HRT. You know, so I wanted to change that narrative because if I could just change one life, if I can affect just one life positively, then I wanted to do that. And so I started to talk about it more.
That's, well, thank you. I mean, I think that is incredibly important. I think that's an understatement for me to say that, but I mean, I think that's really, really impactful. And I'm really glad that you are using your platform, you know, to build awareness, to raise your voice, to make it known, and so that people don't feel isolated or alone, because you know, it's my understanding that's very much that's very easy you know, to have happen.
It is. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you, and it's really interesting because it wasn't, I mean, if you think about it, I've lived my life as two separate genders, right? I've seen both the men's bathroom and the women's bathroom.
Yeah, right.
And it's, you know, and it's funny because as a man, I was aware of the wage disparity posters that would, you know, that hung in the break rooms of companies and, you know, the fact that women were paid less than men, but I didn't, but how many men actually can experience that? Who can right. go from, you know, really walk into a job offer countering and not expect to be countered or negotiated.
Right. No.
To being a woman yeah. and trying to negotiate your salary and the person looking at you like you have four eyes. Like, what do you mean you were trying to negotiate your offer letter with me?
Right.
You know, it's like, it's a real thing. And, you know, and, no, you're, you know, trying to make that argument that no, I'm countering you because you're not offering me what I'm worth. This is what I'm worth. And this is what you're going to pay if you want, irregardless of my gender, regardless of what unconscious biases you think you have or do not have. This is what I'm worth. And this is what you're going to pay me if you want me to work here. And so I think, you know, it's been a very interesting journey for me in my life, being able to say that I've been on both sides of the table and seen what that's like, that wage disparity is a real thing, that women are paid less for the same work that a man does or have to prove something more. And I think what I wasn't really prepared for was also the fact that trans women are seen by many lesbian women as not being real women. So, you know, as yeah. a trans woman, we get that sort of, we get that from both biological right. women or heterosexual, as well as lesbian women who are like, look, you know, you're not a real woman. You don't understand, you know, what we're up against, you know? So it's tough. You know, you just don't know where you belong.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's funny because I never expected, you know, to receive that from the LGBT community, because you would think like, hey, look, you know, you're a lesbian. You understand not feeling welcomed or part of any particular social circle. And so for, you know, women to, and also even biological women who, you know, make that same argument that, hey, look, you know, we're fighting for women's rights. You're not a real woman. You know, don't think that you're part of our club. You know, it's just strange to me, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that it didn't, demotivate you, you know, to speak your truth mm. and to, you know, share that with everyone. Sounds like it did the opposite. So
yeah, it definitely became my fuel.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Yeah. And yeah. I think that's indicative of who you are too, is that you didn't let it dissuade you. It only encouraged you because you know that there are people that are looking for your voice, like I mentioned earlier. So I think that's really admirable.
Thank you.
yeah, of course. And you know, you're someone who has continuously broken down barriers. So definitely not surprising to me. And you, in one of your LinkedIn posts, I don't remember what the title was, but you talked about reinventing yourself. And I think as a content creator, and you mentioned that earlier a little bit, but I'd like to hear a little more, because I think everyone, you know, everyone has been in a point in their lives where they want to reinvent themselves to some degree. And I think that is really powerful as well.
Yeah. One of the things about humans as a species is we're continuously evolving, right? Yeah. We're continuously innovating. We're continuously inventing and reinventing. So why should we not look at ourselves as a continued work in progress, is reinventing ourselves? If we can reinvent the cell phone or even reinvent the telephone, you know, why can't we reinvent ourselves? So I've always lived my life by that, in the fact that, hey, you know, I'm not just one thing, right? So if you look at my YouTube channel, I don't just post videos on hacking connected cars, or, you know, that would be boring for me. I also have videos on there on day trading. This is how you day trade.
Good time, for that. And so
it's just like, I'm all these things. It's just, I've had that question like, hey, Lissa, I see, you're a content creator. I follow you. And do you think it would be weird if I started to blog about other things I'm interested in? Like, why not? Like, we're not one dimensional creatures. We're into other things. Like, you may work in cybersecurity, but maybe you like to go hang gliding, but I mean, it's so, my point being is that I haven't always just been a hacker. I'm also an investor. I'm also a scalper, day trader. I'm also a content creator. And I remember the post you're talking about, and it actually ended up being quite controversial because you don't really hear, and this was when I became an analyst at IT Group. And
that's right.
It was an article about how, I was reinventing myself, that I was going from becoming a hacker to creating content. And honestly, before I was being, I was becoming a content creator at IT Group without realizing I was becoming a content creator. Like, I was starting to write analyst research reports and papers and creating videos. And the idea of content creation was very foreign to me, because before that, it was all about analyzing packets and, hacking things and blowing things up,
right?
I didn't know what a content creator was, but I started to research it more, and I started to like really get excited about it. And then, trying to learn how to edit videos and create video trailers and teasers, and learning DaVinci Resolve and learning how to set up a camera, what's the best camera and what's the best audio equipment. And what do you mean the camera built into my laptop isn't the best camera? What are you talking about? I started to become obsessed about video creation and create, being a YouTuber. And all of a sudden I was a content creator and I didn't know it. And so I had just reinvented myself without knowing it. And I guess I kind of got to a point in my career where I was like, I feel like I've learned everything I wanted to, or could learn, or wanted to learn about cybersecurity and hacking and incident response and forensics and, packet analysis and log analysis. And now I want to reinvent myself and learn something new and be something new. And what I found was, oh my God, I could take this stuff about hacking and this stuff about content creation and merge the two worlds together. And I can work with cybersecurity vendors and write a new kind of white paper that told a story about why a CISO needed the product versus what the product did and how it works. And, because I'm a big believer in Simon Sinek's, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it.
Yeah.
So I was merging these two worlds together and creating just a radically different kind of content, and got, very obsessed with creating videos. And, people want things in the size of a tweet now. They want to watch a 2-minute video. And, I just reinvented myself without realizing I was reinventing myself.
I feel like the theme of breaking is very evident for you. Like, you talked about wanting to take things apart to learn how to put them back together when you were younger. And now it's kind of coming full circle in this way. Like, not only are you reinventing how, others perceive you in the industry, but I think that post, correct me if I'm wrong, was from like 2016. So now it's almost five.
Yeah, it was pretty old.
But at that time, I'm sure not many people were necessarily talking about it in that way, right? Like, that was probably very different for folks to wrap their heads around and kind of understand. Like, but correct me if I'm wrong, like maybe the reception wasn't that was that way, but I bet that you kind of were forging ahead on a new kind of unprecedented path in a way.
Well, it's funny, and you're right. Breaking things has been a recurring theme in my life. Breaking connected cars, hacking into a bank through its CCTV cameras in the parking lot. And at the time, if you think about the analyst industry, it's very ivory tower.
Yeah.
And it's very conservative, and there's a lot of pay for play. And I think people get that. And I didn't like being part of it. So, you know, a lot of people, hey, Alyssa, why did you leave becoming an analyst? Why did you stop? You were had an awesome platform and you had an analyst firm that was, you know, PR, you know, editors and journalists, and it's a lot easier to get access to them as an analyst because they want to interview you for your articles. Why did you leave? And it was because of the fact that I was tired of the ivory tower and the pay for play and the, you know, I didn't want to be a part of that anymore. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to keep creating content and keep breaking things, because I felt like I was breaking the analyst industry where people kind of saw me as a different kind of analyst, you know, breaking barriers in the analyst industry and redefining what an analyst was. But I wanted the guardrails off. I didn't want an analyst firm to tell me what I could and couldn't do and what I could and couldn't say. I'm very against anyone, you know, telling me what I'm allowed to say or not allowed to say. I think people have come to really respect that about me, where they know if I put my name on something, if I'm talking about something, that it's my unadulterated, you know, unfiltered opinion, that, you know, I won't just opine on anything, that, you know, I'm not a pay for play person. If I feel like a solution doesn't do what the product marketing material says it does, I'll say it, you know? And so,
do you think, do you think that makes you better at what you do in general and in life, you know?
I think it's good and it's bad, right? Because it does preclude me from certain things. I mean, you know, there's some organizations that you know, like someone who's a little bit more restrained and, you know, can kind of be massaged and formed, and being given a certain narrative that they will just parrot.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, what's interesting is, you know, it's also given me a lot of opportunity to really change norms.
Yeah.
That we've come to appreciate and respect and follow, but, you know, may not necessarily be the right thing.
Right. And you kind of alluded also to some of your, you know, very infamous breaks, such as CCTVs and cars. Do you want to tell us a little about some of your all-time favorite breaks? And please feel free to dive into the details, because I know that you've really been at the forefront of pen testing embedded systems for a while now.
And for me, if now this goes all the way back, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but back in 2001,
yes,
I spoke at Black Hat briefings, and I actually published the first vulnerability on hacking connected cars. And let me rephrase. I published the first vulnerability back in 2001 on hacking VPNs. And this was virtual private networking was, you know, it's God's gift to security. It's triple DES and it's unhackable. I used to love it when vendors would say it's unhackable. and I was attracted to the idea of a black box, because you didn't have access to source code. You didn't have access to anything. You know, it's just this black box. And I don't know if you remember this Ben Affleck movie. He was hired by companies to break competing products, and then so they could reverse engineer. He was a reverse engineerer. It's a great movie. If you haven't seen it, it's a great movie. That just Ben Affleck is amazing.
What? Yeah. But, I'm trying to think of which that's called.
Do you know which one I'm talking about?
I think so.
Yeah, he was. Hold on. That's gonna bug me. Ben Affleck, reverse engineer movie. Paycheck.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have seen that.
Paycheck,
that was a great movie.
From 2003.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was me, right? I loved breaking things that I didn't know anything about, didn't have a screen. And, you know, so this goes all the way back. This was really encoded in my DNA from when I first really got into security at a professional level. And today have really brought that further. So much to your point, you know, I've had some epic hacks in embedded systems. And I think probably my favorite has really been recently. And I don't know if you saw this, but I just dropped a trailer on Friday, a few days ago, which is the second trailer on me hacking law enforcement vehicles. And so
okay, I saw the first, but not the second.
Yeah, you gotta see, it's good. Okay. It's got an even better soundtrack. Ooh. It's got great music. Yeah, background music is awesome. So in 2019, I was approached by senior law enforcement officials after I published my book. Actually, it was Q1 of 2020, and published in my new book on hacking connected cars in February. And then I was contacted by law enforcement because they were concerned about the attack surface of law enforcement vehicles. Could an adversary take remote control of an LE vehicle? And obviously any vulnerabilities affecting state law enforcement, like police cars, affect federal vehicles and DHS and FBI, because they all use the same type of cars. And was successful. I found vulnerabilities. I was able to remotely stop and start the engine of a law enforcement vehicle and lock and unlock the car doors from my home, from anywhere. And so this turned into a really awesome documentary that law enforcement allowed me to film. And so that I would say probably the most exciting vulnerability research I've ever done was the law enforcement stuff. And I'm in the midst of it right now. I just presented to the federal law enforcement agencies on Friday some of my findings, and have been contacted by the Secret Service and DHS to talk about it further. And so it's really exciting. You know, this year, I don't know if you saw, I don't know. I treat my life like it's Hollywood, right?
So I like that.
I missed my calling for DreamWorks, but
well, not I, really. I mean, you're working on it though. I think.
I'm kind of doing it. Yeah, yeah. Like my own Alyssa Knight DreamWorks. But I made this. I have this tendency to make these videos at the end of every year, kind of celebrating my accomplishments, and a new video at the beginning of the year about what I'm going to be focusing on that year. And I wrote a new one. I produced a new trailer for 2021. And I think that dropped a few weeks ago, but it talks about my mHealth research and how I downloaded and hacked 30 mobile health apps, because that's a very prevalent concern right now. Everyone's visiting their doctors and mental health therapists over mobile apps. And so this new genre of apps is about 300,000 apps in the app store around mobile health.
Wow.
And I wanted to know what the attack surface was with mobile health apps. And so, you know, the vulnerabilities, of course, were systemic, and, you know, was able to access other patient records and got mobile health companies involved in the research, who allowed me to target and attack their APIs and produce a video on it and produce a report on it. So that's the kind of stuff I like to do, is raise awareness around things like that, so we can do better as developers, so we can do better security engineers, and start to shift security left rather than right. Anyway, my point is 2021 is going to be really epic. I've got this dope research coming out for where I've been brought in to hack a connected train. I've been brought in to hack a connected super yacht. I had no idea yachts were floating around on the ocean with IP addresses, but it's a thing. So I like to, it's that, if you remember that old movie, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah, yeah, you're exactly.
Candy. Yeah. So I'm kind of the modern day trains, planes, and automobiles girl, and boats.
And boats. Yeah, they didn't go on any boats. They didn't go on any boats, but they should have. And if they did,
that would have been great.
That would have been awesome. And you talk about these, you know, incredible breaks that you've done, but you've also received some flack from the community for not being a programmer as well. I was reading some of that, of like the heat that you've taken for that.
It's crazy. It's crazy. And that's what I'm talking about in the industry. I'm glad you brought that question up. You know, there's this belief that's held by certain individuals in the industry, and of course they're programmers.
Well, yeah.
that you're not really this elite hacker unless you know how to write code. That you're dependent on other people's ability to write exploits for you, or, you know, you're not going to be able to find as many vulnerabilities. But if you think about it, you know, I published the first vulnerability on hacking VPNs. I've written and published a book on hacking connected cars, and I'm hacking yachts and hacking trains. And you don't get access to source code. You don't get to look at source code. Like, I've also been branded as this API hacker. You can analyze or look at the source code of the endpoint API. You know, so I've never needed to be a developer, and I hate that, because it's almost like I really believe that adversaries want us to be not all inclusive, that that adversaries want us to be, to exclude as many people as we can because it makes fewer defenders.
Right.
You know, and I feel like we need to be more inclusive. Just invite everyone in, whether they're programmers or not, whether they're woman or man or gay or straight or trans or, you know, like let's invite everyone in because we need all the help we can get. And so I never understood this. And you're right. I've gotten heat from it on Twitter. I've gotten heat from it on LinkedIn. Just people coming in. So, you know, how can you call yourself a hacker? You're not a programmer. Well, you know, I've met some amazing breakers that couldn't write a line of code to save their life. I'm one of them, you know, and I have, you know, that now this big thing is, how many CVEs do you have to your name? That for some reason is a new thing. This woman on LinkedIn got heat from this troll because he asked her, you know, name all the CVEs and, you know, what CVs do you have in your name? It's so stupid.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I have CVs, right? Who cares, but you know, who cares? And, I don't know how to program. And so don't get me wrong. I have an enormous amount of respect for people that can write code. I never got into it. I'm more of a visual. I'm an artist. I love to do charcoal drawings. I'm a very creative artistic person. I'm a visual person, and I couldn't fathom staring at lines of code all day. It just doesn't sound sexy to me. You know, I mean, but that's amazing. If I can go to you and say, Hillary, write me a script or write me a program that does this. And you being able to just kick that out. That's amazeballs.
Yeah. That's but me for that's sure. Me.
You pulled my number.
I'm
Alyssa.
Your lady.
Awesome.
That brings me to another point, which you mentioned on ITSP speaking with Chloe, and we actually, I had Chloe on the show as well. And we talked about She's hacking is not a crime. Her. She's wonderful. Yeah. But we talked about how there's that back and forth on how hackers perceived in our media as a negative and industry folks disagree. Like, and you call yourself a hacker, so obviously you don't necessarily view it in that negative light, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that issue.
Yeah. So, you know, I struggle with labels,
sure,
right? Like whether you call them adversaries or black hats or hackers. Look, I mean, like anyone can be a hacker, right? I mean, hacking someone, social engineering someone is hacking a human, right? You know, I even, you know, obviously in my personal life, you know, and I apologize, I got her name wrong. It's actually Angela Marafino and Chantel, but Chloe is also amazing. Okay. I absolutely love Chloe.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm horrible with names.
No, it's fine.
I struggle with labels. You know, for me, I think I've kind of thrown that card around. I've used the H word. I've used the B word. I've used, you know, to refer to, and yeah, there's been some trolls that have attacked me for that, but I don't know. I think we need to focus less on the labels and more on the actual content of people's character and, you know, the ultimate objective.
I think it kind of goes with what you said earlier, is that labels divide us. And if we're divided, then we can't be united in protecting all of us. So I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, and okay, I get it. Don't get me wrong. I get it. You need to be able to classify certain people or where they sit. Like, are they a breaker? Are they a defender? Are they purple team, blue team, red team? But it starts to become too much. Like even this whole red team, blue team, that didn't exist 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, and you're like, colors, are we gang members now? Like, what's what side, like what side do I die? But you know, I feel like I get it. I think we as a human race need to be able to classify people, like, are you a boy or are you a girl? You know, like, I need to understand, you know. But I just feel like I wish we could evolve above that. You know, at the end of the day, we're just all security professionals, and we're all, because it's, you know, How awful is that if someone comes in thinking like, but I don't want to be a programmer. Does that mean I can't work in security? Okay, I'm going to need to go find another profession. Or, you know, I don't want to be a hacker. I want to detect hackers, you know. So if I choose red, does that mean I can't be blue? You know, and it starts to introduce those questions and the potential to ostracize people and keep them out of our industry. But hashtag more, please, you know, more, more women, more people. Like you said, we need to, you know, we can't be divided in order to conquer.
And I liked when you, to backtrack quickly, I liked when you talked about how you celebrate your accomplishments each year. I think that's when we talk about women in cyber, and then what you've shared, that's something that we don't often do as women. We don't celebrate accomplishments in that way.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the fact of the matter is we all have achievements in our own, you know, and at our own level and in our own areas of our life, whether, you know, it's achieving, you know, being able to keep the house running while also working a full-time career, you know, being an awesome mother, being an awesome father, being an awesome single mother, single father, you know, while also being the CISO for a bank or being, you know, just juggling all the things that we do and still bring it, you know, like deal with life. And honestly, God, this, we could do a whole segment on this, on, you know, work from home and how that's changed the dynamic of, you know, work-life balance. And I've always thought that argument was so stupid. As an employer, right? Being a serial entrepreneur, I've employed many, many people. And, you know, my employees are like my family. They're like my children. And, you know, I've always thought that whole argument of trying to balance work-life, it has always just been so asinine because you can't keep them separate. They're always going to be intertwined.
Right.
You know, if someone is worried about their mounting credit card debt, or creditors coming after them, or not being able to qualify for that mortgage loan, and, or, you know, not knowing how they're going to pay the rent while still working, that's going to affect their job performance. It's going to affect them. You can't separate the two. And I think COVID has really helped us sort of have a better understanding of the merger of those two worlds, where some companies are like, no, we are not ever moving back to offices. Everyone's going to work from home. Oh, you've got you're a mother. You've got children that you need to run to either breastfeed or, you know, you can't afford a babysitter or your partner is out. But, you know, I mean, I feel like that's sort of had to force us to recognize that work-life is the same thing. And, you know, it's, you just have to make way for that as an employer. But I completely lost track of your
No, that's good. I think that's good. It's good for you to bring that up too, because another topic we talk about a lot here is the cyber talent gap. And I think it can be a really intimidating industry to get into, because people are worried about not being able to juggle all of the things and be responsible for security. You know, like that's a big responsibility that people don't take lightly. And I think it also dissuades a lot of different people from going into cybersecurity. And I think you're right. I think that COVID has started to change that for us. And I hope that it changes it in a way where more people want to get into this industry, because everyone has something different to offer. And
agreed.
You don't have to have that squeaky clean linear path to be here.
I'm so glad that companies are starting to change this. Even the big five consulting firms like Ernst & Young and, you know, Deloitte, they're starting to stop requiring a degree. It's just so stupid to me. I mean, first of all, not everyone can afford to go to college.
Right.
Just because, you know, and it's recruiters, the recruiting industry, and even hiring managers complain about the global talent shortage, yet they're looking for people who live and or are willing to relocate to Kansas to come work for the job. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Like, talent, you need to go where the talent is, right? We're finally getting away from this industrial revolution mindset of, you know, 9 to 5, you know, coming into the office, the lunch whistle, you know, ridiculous. It's beanbag chairs and hours that I am the most productive and where I want to work. I don't care where you live. If you want to sit on a recliner on the beach in, you know, Cancun while doing a penetration test for me, do it.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to go where the talent is. And I think we as humans just don't always get it right. We just don't get it right. We need to be able to admit that when we got it wrong. And I just feel like that's one thing we never got right, was requiring people to relocate or hire locally, and not being able to look outside of that zip code, you know, to find talent. You want the best people, and they're not always going to be living in Utah not to pick on Utah, but you know, Kansas or, the Dakotas.
Right. Or maybe they are, but you're not, and you should be able to still employ
them.
They're
in the Dakotas and you're in Silicon Valley. Right. And they don't want to pay $10,000 a month for a one bedroom.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And, you mentioned, your team and employing folks. So what's ahead for you this year? I mean, tell us about your latest business endeavors.
Company. So I'm about to announce something really big that I can't talk about yet. But I will drop it on your show though. As soon as I'm allowed to talk about it, if you invite me back, I'll drop it on your show.
Yeah.
So I'm going to announce something really huge. So there's that. So we'll call that the anonymous, the unknown surprise of 2021. I'm going to continue to hack more passenger vehicles, whether it's planes or rotary wing aircraft or boats or trains, continue to produce more content. I'm really big into APIs. I'm going to be focusing a lot on vulnerability research and APIs this year and the work around that. And I don't know, it's just continuing the same thing and just, I guess, shocking people. I like shock and awe. So I guess the answer to your question is # shock and awe.
I like that.
That's what's going to be the continued theme for Alyssa Knight.
That's a good, I mean, we are only right now as we speak a month into 2021. And I think that your # really applies for 2021, even just after a month. Great. I mean, it's been a wild ride so far. So I'm excited for where the future takes you. I'm excited to keep connecting with you. I'm going to take you up on you dropping it on our show, the quote unquote unknown surprise. I'm very much looking forward to that.
Me too, Hillary.
And I mean, I guess as we start to wrap up, I know that we talked about a lot of different things. The one thing that I wanted to ask you, just because, if anyone is listening, we do talk a lot about women in cybersecurity, but I haven't had many opportunities to talk about what it's like for trans women in cybersecurity. So for any trans people listening, you know, if they're interested in this industry or they have a tinge of, oh, well, I'm a little curious about that, but I'm not really sure. Like, what should they know? What advice would you have for them? But then also, I guess, for everyone in the cyber industry, but because that is close to you, I wanted to give you that platform.
I think, you know, there's, you know, obviously, whether you're a trans woman or a biological woman or, you know, whatever gender you identify as, everyone, all of us are always dealing with imposter syndrome. So fight through that. The best advice I can offer trans women wanting to work in cybersecurity or are in cybersecurity already is, you know, you don't have to prove anything to anyone but yourself, right? The doubt is the best salesman out there. And you just, you know, all I can recommend is push through it and bring it, just bring it, you know, bring your best self and continue to provide, to just bring that grit and, you know, that desire an ambition to learn and, you know, be your best self. And you've got, you're not up against anyone except yourself. And that's oftentimes is the worst critic. We're our own worst critics. And you just need to be able to, like we mentioned, celebrate your wins, you know, celebrate the things that you that you're blessed for and that you've been able to achieve and accomplish against all odds. And, but also be cognizant of what you still want to accomplish and never lose sight of that.
That was great. Wow. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Alyssa, I can't thank you enough for coming onto the show. This has been absolutely fantastic. And I just thank you so much for the time and for sharing your story with us. And I'm really looking forward to speaking with you again.
Well, it's me too. And it's meant a lot being invited onto your show and I appreciate it. And I look forward to being back.
Yeah.
And being a part of this story that you guys have as well at Cybercrime Magazine. And so thank you. Thank you for the recognition. If anyone wants to get a hold of me or follow me or reach out to me to ask questions or get advice, I love to mentor people and provide guidance as well. You can either follow me on LinkedIn or on Twitter. And I do actually respond to messages.
Well, that's great. Well, Alyssa, thank you again. This was great.
Thanks, Hillary.
I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today was Alyssa Valentina Knight, and if you'd like to learn more about her, go to alyssaknight.com. And for more on cybercrime and cybersecurity, you can listen to all of our podcast episodes at cybercrime.radio.